Welcome to a very special episode of the McFuture podcast. I feel like I'm talking about a very Brady Christmas or something. Today's episode is all about myth busting. And I have 12 myths for you. There are 10 in this episode and 2 in the bonus episode. Everyone comes up to me and they're like, oh, I love the show. Oh, you make me think differently about all these different subjects. Or I used one of your ideas and didn't credit you in a meeting recently. Well, that's all great. But the best way to show me your love is to show your support. So I'm going to create a link in the show notes and on the website to support the Patreon for this show. It's sort of like a recurring Kickstarter where you give a few bucks a month and you get some bonuses. The next 2 episodes are going to be amazing, and both of them will have bonus material. The first is the future of all media, and the second is even more ambitious, the future of lying. You will not want to miss them. Today, I want to talk about something that is really important for the future, and it's really important for innovation. When I look at the world, I'm thinking, does this need to exist? Unfortunately, sometimes I'm looking at a human being and they're beyond the statute of limitations on abortion. So I don't have that option. So I made a list of 12 things that we assume to be true, but they're actually myths or outright lies. 10 of them are in this episode, and 2 are in the bonus episode for Patreon supporters. And these things are ripe for innovation or a reimagining of how our society works. So let's get into it. Myth number 1, that our kids have to be digitally savvy. We think that being connected is a good thing. Look at all the money school districts paid to Apple to get iPads, which, by the way, I'm sure those batteries are dead by now and those things are broken. I don't think kids should be trusted with iPads. And Chromebooks. Oh my God, Google, they subsidize the hell out of that operating system. They give it away for free. And these Chinese manufacturers pump them out super cheap, all to get you hooked on Google services. But you know who doesn't use these tools? The people who make them. All the tech billionaires, they know better than anybody that you can't get high on your own supply. And you can't deny that I'm so fly that I'm soaring to the sky. Okay, seriously. They don't allow any of this stuff into their homes. Melinda Gates, their kids don't use smartphones. They only have a computer in the kitchen and an old fax machine named Steve. Bill Gates, he sits around reading books. He's not online. He's not using Microsoft products. He's done with that. Same thing goes for all of the executives at eBay, Apple, Uber, Zuckerberg. He wants his daughter reading Dr. Seuss. He doesn't want her chatting with Russian trolls on Facebook. All of them send their kids to these Montessori schools to learn to play with blocks and to play with glue, not to eat the glue, as I did when I was a kid. They don't want their kids touching any of this stuff. You know, on some level, I'm convinced that the rich people who send their kids to Montessori schools just like saying the word Montessori. I think it's like brie or quinoa. Anyone who knows how to say quinoa properly is probably an asshole. I think the same thing applies to Montessori. Oh, Reginald goes to a Montessori school. Sorry, you can't afford Montessori. Your kids do not have enough money. They all know what this does to people. All these things are engineered for addiction. Those little alerts, those are little tiny dopamine hits. It's like, oh, someone liked something I did. Oh, it's not enough for an orgasm. It's just enough for, you know, for someone just to touch you down there. Oh, touch, you know, touch, touch. But no finish. I'm a little bit optimistic here because I think Generation Z is a little bit smarter. They did a survey in 2016. 66% of 18 to 24-year-olds thought that social media was important to them. But then 2 years later, it dropped from 66 to 57%. So maybe they're heading in the right direction, which is great. But old people, what the hell is wrong with you? People 45 plus, that same statistic about social media increased from 23 to 28%. And if you're relying on Apple to save you, oh boy, or any of these companies, you know, Apple put out this app that lets you track how much time you're spending on the device to save you from using it too much. It was called the Time Well Spent Timer. Guess what happened? They totally just got rid of that because they just launched a gaming service and then they launched a streaming service and a news service. They don't want you to cut use of the device. How are they going to make money? They want you addicted. They want you staring at that screen. Is there anybody left who believes this narrative? Here's the real truth. The ability to resist porn and social media and all of these other digital temptations is going to prove to be the biggest evolutionary advantage someone can have, especially for men. And this is stoicism. These are stoic habits that need to be developed from youth, the same as brushing and reading and exercise and nutrition. All of these things need to be embedded into our brains. And the sooner you give a child a tablet, the sooner their brain gets wired into the matrix. And it's easy. I get it because, you know, it's cheaper than babysitting. You can give your kid one of these devices, come back like 4 days later, and they're still like somehow playing with it. I mean, they're probably asleep and super hungry, but they're hopefully alive and totally addicted. It's the easy thing, and we can't afford to do it any longer. Take a hint from the people who built those things. Myth number two. We never, ever question all of these tax advantage savings plans like 401ks, IRAs, FSAs for healthcare, HSAs, there's so many A's. We've all become a-holes. We pay billions in fees to the financial industry that lobbies for these things to exist. All of them have their own sales force and their own administration and pamphlet designers. Someone sitting around going, no, I don't think this woman looks concerned enough about her finances. We need to find a different woman. So, you know, this is a taxpayer-funded jobs program. People say government doesn't create jobs. Oh, I could not disagree more. Government does nothing but create jobs. Every single law, every single rule creates an entire cottage industry of worthless jobs. People who are not even alive enough to dream. They're not going to rise to their potential. All they're doing is shuffling paperwork from one place to the other. And think of the millions of hours a year that all of us waste administering all this stuff. You know what the government could do is just cut taxes and then you can save for your own healthcare, you can save for your own 401ks, you can save for all of that stuff. Or if you want to help people out, you redistribute it. So this is a huge wealth transfer to financial services companies. I used to work for this major US company. And the 401k plan was from a company you would never choose in a million years. In a world with Vanguard and Fidelity and T. Rowe Price, they somehow chose this like fourth string company. And then I realized the reason they choose them is all the fees are buried in the crappy overpriced funds. So you end up paying the fees and the company gets a service for free. Also, this is extremely regressive, which means it helps rich people way more than it helps poor people. So the more money you earn, the more you can afford these plans. It doesn't even help successful people properly. The guy who invented it, like Dr. Frankenstein, wants to murder his own creation because it gave companies an excuse to not provide a pension. Here's your 401k. We'll give you a little 2% match. Now try to figure out how to make that last your whole retirement. Most people are not saving nearly enough to retire on. I'm going to start developing a taste for dog food. I figure I'm going to end up eating kibble at some point in my retirement. Chicken claw with a hint of retired thoroughbred. I'd like to say there's an easy answer to this. Well, there is one. I think you march into the office on Monday, dressed like Conan the Barbarian in a tiger skin loincloth, and just start clubbing the 401k administrator to death. No, I'm kidding. That's just a joke. No, I think the solution is just to know that you're living a lie every day you make one of these deductions. Myth number three, how we file taxes every year is perfectly normal. The idea that we ask 350 million people, hey, how much did you earn last year? And have them fill out a form when your employer reports everything. All of your financial institutions, they'll report everything, and everything is tied to your social security number. There should be nothing to fill out. Maybe they can email you something where you take a look and go, this looks about right. Click a button and you're done. Intuit, who makes TurboTax, they spend millions on lobbying every single year to keep the tax code more complicated than marrying a heroin addict. Those guys, they love it. The more lines in the tax code, the more complicated it is, the more ridiculous deductions, the better they are. Same thing goes for the accounting industry. Our goal should be to fit the entire tax code on one page. And then all of these deductions and incentives for poor people and all that stuff, those have to be separate programs because all this stuff never goes away. Our tax code now is millions of lines. No one deletes anything. And what happens is it turns me into a criminal because everyone is in violation of something if you look hard enough. All right, myth number four. The idea that home ownership is essential or important. Before I get into the bad stuff, there are good things. If you have the money and you want to buy a home, knock yourself out. If you have a family, it's a great place to store your children and your dog. You can't have a dog in an apartment. You need some place to crap outside. I mean, I'd like to crap outside if it's a nice day. In fact, it's a great way for you to get into an area where your kids can go to a great school because all of that schooling is funded by your property taxes. So you've now successfully segregated yourself from the unwashed masses. Congrats. Even on an individual level, home ownership is not so spectacular. First of all, you don't exactly own your home. Let's do a little experiment. Why don't you try not paying your property taxes for 3 years. Let's see what happens when you don't make the payments to the bank on your mortgage. Between the government and the bank, you don't own anything either for a long time or forever, depending on the taxes in that state. You're still renting. Now, we've created this insane thing where we're giving cash back to rich people. This is another regressive thing. There is no economist that would not agree that the home interest deduction is regressive. It basically helps rich people. This thing is an absurd incentive that we've built in, and I don't know if it was the product of lobbying because I'm too lazy to do the homework, but I'm sure that's part of it. But the idea that this is our assumption, we take this as a given, is ridiculous. And the payoff on a home investment is not really guaranteed either. It's not a bad investment only because it's not liquid, so it forces you to save because you're building equity. But it's not necessarily the best investment if you have money that you can invest in the stock market or in other things. And if you're looking at co-ops and condos, you own nothing. You don't own land. You have to pay maintenance charges forever. And you're locked into constant negotiations with idiot neighbors, like busybodies. If you meet somebody, and I don't know if I'm talking to a person like this, if you are, then you're gonna hate me, but who cares? If you meet somebody who is on the board of their co-op, they're only there for one of two reasons. The first reason is they're a busybody that has unlimited time to be an asshole and to make other people's lives miserable. Because they just want to control others because maybe they have no control otherwise in their empty, horrible lives and their cats lick their faces in the morning. They're sour, salty, awful faces. Or the other kind of person who joined a board who's been horrifically abused by one of these imbeciles and had to join the board to fight them off. And it's not going to be difficult to tell which is which. You can meet them at a party and instantly know. You know why? Because the only one you're going to meet at a party is the second type. The other people, they don't get invited to parties because they're assholes. And that's why they join the board. Because all these people are having parties and making all this noise and they're not invited. sometimes people, they'll buy houses next to their job, and there may only be one or two major employers in that area. When one of those employers moves, they're screwed. No one wants to buy that house because that area is now damaged. Their property values sink, and now they're stuck because all of their savings are wrapped up in this one place. But if someone's a renter, they're mobile. They can get up and go. Now, renting has other negatives. For example, renters aren't going to improve their communities. It's the same way you treat a rental car. You crap that thing up, there's going to be a bunch of Snickers wrappers and McNuggets and spent bullet casings. All the staples of the American lifestyle. There's been a bunch of studies that show that there's absolutely no correlation between economic prosperity and home ownership. Some of the most successful European countries have way lower home ownership than we do and a much higher standard of living. Germans are on vacation all the time. I don't even know, like, they have this reputation for working. I have a bunch of German friends. They are always on vacation. I gotta ask them about this next time I see them. Same thing with Japanese. Same thing with people from Netherlands and Denmark. All of them have way more disposable income and they're all freaking renters. So tell me how essential owning a home is. Who's more free, the renter or the owner? Plus, we created Freddie Mac to essentially back all of these home loans. And that's what caused the crisis. Because of course you're going to give people unlimited money if you know you'll get it back from the government. We take it for granted that, oh, this is normal. We need to own homes and the government needs to support that. It is not true. Myth number five, the state sanctioning of marriage. I'll take it a step further. The state profiting from marriage. Who invited government into your bedroom? And this is where I get super libertarian, even though, you know, I'm okay with some government intervention, but in your sex life, in who you marry, what the hell? Why, like, is Trump in your bedroom making dear sweet love to your woman? Mon chéri, I am going to make beautiful, sweet, compassionate love as long as he keeps filming. By the way, Trump puts on a French accent when he makes love to your wife. Sorry, I digress. But the idea that we're going to let government decide who gets married and then to get divorced, that costs thousands of dollars too. So the state is involved in all of this. And I understand on some level that we want to encourage families and all this other stuff, but I have to believe there's a better way to do that than for government to be in the business of marriage. And it is a business, by the way. When gay marriage got approved, the wedding industry exploded because they've never seen anyone pickier than these guys who are like eager to get married for decades. And finally, oh my God, we got to get triple the flowers. We're going to have to get double the size of the venue because this is a celebration. Anyway, there's a lot of pent up demand. So the idea that marriage is not a business, marriage is nothing but a business, but not government business. And it really should be a covenant between two people. Now, that could be a religious covenant, or it could be just a contractual one if you're not religious. So two people can say, hey, we want to be together, and here are the terms on which we want to be together. No one's thinking about that because we've just taken this for granted. Oh, of course, government's going to sanction our relationship. Myth number six, political sides and political parties. Somehow, we've all accepted that there are two sides to every story or to every issue. Only a child would look at something and go, well, it's either round or it's square, you know, or it's it's left or it's right. If you picture the universe of correct answers for any issue, it's this vast, let's picture it as a circle. The two parties that we deal with every day maybe overlap that circle by a tiny, tiny fraction. They don't know the correct answers. They just know their partisan answers. But we've somehow assumed there's two sides to an issue. So with this podcast and other things that I do, I'm going to encourage you to look at things completely differently, as if those two sides did not exist. And I know they're super loud, and I know they're prevalent, and I know they have power, which makes it that much more important that we question them and beat the crap out of them to get better answers. And that's the entire point behind the healthcare series that I did. If you haven't listened to it yet, listen to it, because it takes a completely different direction from the two sides that we keep hearing over and over again. Myth number 7. We're almost there, kids. The H-1B visa. This thing is nutty. So H-1B, I'm going to oversimplify it, but basically the way it works is it's a business visa. So you can bring specialized workers in from other countries. And there's a quota and limit for how many you can have. And typically these middlemen and lawyers have kind of cornered the market, and they're the ones who do all the filings on behalf of these giant companies like Microsoft and Google and whatever. But what this system does is, first of all, it only supports giant corporations. No small company can afford to do this because of the expense of filing. And you got to apply by March, but these workers can't start working until September. What small business can afford that? And what it also does, and this is the thing we never talk about, is it creates a class of indentured servants who have an advantage over domestic workers. These are people who can't just get up and go to another company. They need sponsorship. So they basically can't leave, which means you can pay them less because they're coming from some country where they could never make this kind of money. So even if you get them close to what your current workers pay, they're going to be super grateful. They're going to worship you. They're going to sleep in the office. They're loving it. And they can work longer hours because they have no families here. Typically, some do bring their families, but for the most part, these are people that you can tether to their desks. You throw them some kibble every once in a while and they sit there. And I've been party to this, and I've worked with companies or for companies that do this, and it creates a separate class of workers. And I don't think they do it intentionally, but if you give someone an advantage, of course they're going to take it, especially big companies. Small ones can't afford it. Anyway, it's a ridiculous system. I know Trump's been criticizing it, but I can't tell if it's a coherent argument or not. And that's not to say we shouldn't have immigration. We should, but we shouldn't create indentured servants only for giant corporations. Psst, I have a secret. I'll tell you my salary. No. Be quiet. I'm not supposed to say it. Myth number 8. Do you know who benefits from us not talking about how much we earn? The employer. And companies love this. They promote salary privacy. Some of them ban sharing how much people make. They want you negotiating in the dark. Somehow, culturally, we got convinced that this is the right way to behave. But if you look at Europe, they talk about salary all the time. And they talk about wine and cheese and soccer. It really is paradise. Here, the employer has all the advantages. They know exactly how much everybody earned, and they have third parties that they share this through. So there's something run by Equifax, of course, the keeper of the gates, Equifax, that has never screwed up ever before. Same thing goes for this super secret Silicon Valley database that all these companies share. So when a candidate comes in, they know exactly what they've earned and know what to bid on it. That means all of your future pay is based on your history, not on your value. That is overall holding salaries down. There is a company called Glassdoor that does track individual salaries, but it's very spotty. It's inconsistent. Some of the information is out of date, and it doesn't even the playing field, not even close. Luckily, New York State swooped in to rescue us. They decided, no, you cannot ask anybody for their history. And everyone's like, yeah, New York State, you go, girl. Except it's government. They did it half-assed. No, you can't ask for people's salary history, but you can use as a filter their salary expectations. So there's no form that you can fill out on one of these company applications where salary isn't mandatory. So you just have to put in what you expect, except you respond like a battered spouse. You're so used to getting beaten down by the system. You end up lowballing yourself, and there's no way to get past that screen. And as my recurring theme, the government has failed to rescue you once again. There are a couple of companies in Silicon Valley like Netflix that not only share salaries, they share all the comp. For them, it's great for culture and recruiting, but unless someone forces the issue, you're not going to see Disney or all these legacy companies go, oh, here's what everybody earns. One of the reasons you see such high salaries in sports is everybody knows what everyone is trying to make. And the agents, they leak it. They probably just tweet it at this point to the media because they want to up the price. If there's a higher number out there, then someone's going to maybe try to top it. Steve Factor earns $200 million a year. So if someone out there is able to pay, let's say, $201 million, let's talk. Steve at ideafactory.com. Look, a lot of people think unions are the answer. I don't know if they are, they're not, but certainly times have changed since our factory days because there are no factories. Back then, you had 16-hour days and children were working. You get beaten up by a bunch of goons trying to cross the picket line, or every other day you lose a hand and like 2-3 days in, you're working with your stumps and you're losing your stumps. Today, very different, right? How dare we not have almond M&Ms in the snack drawer? Or the vent in your cubicle, ooh, makes it too cold in here. Or your boss addresses you by the wrong pronoun. You know, they're grievances and they have some legitimacy, but I don't think they'd have the same impact or get the same sympathy from the masses. There's a lot that could be done to even the playing field between giant, powerful parties and small, powerless ones. But when it comes to wages, just starting with transparency could change a lot. And transparency may be the answer to a lot more things. I'm going to get into it way more in a future episode. But for now, get out there and start sharing your salary. Go tattoo it on your face. Get that Mike Tyson special. By now, they probably have that tattoo that could change whenever you get a raise. So you just shake your head like an Etch-a-Sketch, and then you could write the new number in. Myth number 9, high margins attract competition. The traditional thinking in business school is, hey, if you've got a super profitable business, that's going to attract a bunch of competitors that are going to drive your profit down. Well, the rules are now completely different because of technology. So I'm working on something called the tech theory of innovation, which I'll probably bring up in a future episode. But the idea there is that the markets that attract competition and disruption aren't the ones with the highest margins necessarily, but they're the ones with the highest amount of fragmentation and inefficiency. So for example, you look at taxi cabs. Taxis were a mess. They're super local, super fragmented. They're kind of in bed with the local politicians. And then you had car services where you're calling some dude and he's going to come straight from some third world country with a stinky back seat. You're going to get into that car and hopefully survive the trip. It was a terrible experience and it was completely disorganized. So this opportunity was created not because it's super profitable, because trust me, that guy from Durkistan, that guy, he does not make much money, and neither does the company that works out of that shitty office that they sit in. What made it attractive was the ability to aggregate buyers and sellers or providers on a single platform. So all of these scattered people go to one place, like an Uber app, to be more efficiently dispatched. Another example would be Netflix in Hollywood. If you've ever been on a movie set, there's a bunch of guys eating donuts. There's a ton of waiting around. Everyone's on their phone. It is not remotely efficient. They have no idea which show is going to be a success. That's why you see all these sequels or rehashes like Starsky and Hutch or 21 Jump Street, shows that were crappy when they were first run. They keep digging them up to de-risk the whole thing with a known brand. Who in their right mind would enter a market this unpredictable? Netflix can. Netflix can shove Sandra Bullock in your face. They could just stuff her in your face, because every time you open that website or the app, you will see Bird Box. You could not escape it. That is what happens when you can control the platform, you control the distribution, and you can make something even mediocre into a hit. And that movie was just okay, but it was in your face so much, eventually they just beat you into submission. Okay, I'll watch it just so the banner will change. I'm going to get into more of that next episode on the future of media. And the last one, except for the two in the bonus episode, myth number 10, college as a given. We have a lot of presidential candidates talking about the importance of college or making college free. Are they looking at the same numbers I'm looking at? Because it's not working. And I think I may have mentioned this in a previous episode. 50% of the people graduating are not going to jobs that require degrees, and certainly not the degree that they have. There are a ton of crappy schools charging way too much for degrees that don't matter. And to encourage that on the taxpayer's dime is completely bonkers. Why would we do that? The only time it makes sense is if your parents are Steven Spielberg. Can he be both parents? I think he's married to someone famous, right? Anyway, but the idea that you are going to get a liberal arts degree from any university and your parents are not Will and Jada Smith, you're nuts. It's like you might as well just set your parents' money on fire. And you're going to be in debt for years. For what? The only degrees that work are basically trade schools. Medicine, law, engineering, financial services. And that's great. If you want to be in one of those trades, you'll be able to pay off your loans and live an awesome life. That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. If you enjoy this, support the show. In the show notes, there's a link to join the Patreon. That'll give you access to all the bonus material, including two extra myths that weren't in this episode. And of course, if you enjoy the show, share it with others, put a review on iTunes or your favorite platform, and I'll see you next week on the McFuture.